12.5 billion watts capacity in one nuclear power station. I think I'd pass that one back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Whenever you read any of these reports about this nuclear power station puts out this number of megawatts, or thousands of kilowatts, they sometimes use those units, and they say it's good for X number of households, you do that calculation and find out that on average, the household is consuming 2,000 watts. Yeah. If I turn on every single burner of my electric range, my electric dryer and everything else, I probably can get to numbers like 30 or 40 kilowatts of consumption. Let's see, I've got, I've only got a 100 ampere house at 260. I can only go to 26 kilowatts. But the average house, if you average over a 24-hour day, is something like 2,000 watts. So if I've got a 600 megawatt power station, that's 6 times 10 to the 8, and 2 times 10 to the 3, so 3 times 10 to the 5, a third of a million houses, I can in theory feed, if I did the numbers right, with a 600 megawatt power station.
Okay, well, gigawatts.
Yes, some of them go to gigawatts, but not very many, and that's rare. A 600 megawatt nuclear power station, that's kind of a big deal. As you make them bigger and bigger, they get a little bit more risky. You gotta twist the tail of that dragon very slowly. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I think a billion watts out of a typical nuclear power station is probably conservative, because you figure that there's losses in the transformers, the power lines, everything going down, getting to the distribution level. So it's quite a bit. It's rather impressive, and apparently turning these things down is quite a chore. And that's if they know. One of the problems I think that they have is with the cooling system is once the cooling system fails, your ability to start turning things down becomes kind of limited. So it's kind of like that. You're really depending on that cooling system dramatically. And in other words, if you had to turn down the load, or the source to this to the reactor, as long as it's cooling, it's really not all that difficult to do. But it's still difficult even there. But if the cooling system fails, boy, is it limited. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW. KC2QIQ.
And they also question, what do you think could happen that 15 minutes before the earthquake, the aurora was noticed and taken on the video on the, over the sky of Japan, exactly at the epicenter of the earthquake?
Okay, well, one at a time now. The Shoreham nuclear station on Long Island, what's your guess as to the size that was supposed to be had it been turned on full blast, if you happen to know, Glenn?
Dick, I think that was approximately a 5 billion watt station if it ever came up to full power. I don't think they ever got to that. I think they were powering as many as like 20,000 homes at one particular time before it was eventually pulled off grid, which was like 2% power or something like that.
So you think that was a how many gigawatts do you think that was?
5 billion watt capacity, not giga, but 5 billion. Still, that's quite a bit.
What's the difference between 5 gigawatts and 5 billion watts?
My bad.
I don't think it was anywhere near that big. I think it was in the 600 meg category, but we'll find that out. But now, and when it comes to these big numbers coming out of a nuclear power station, are we talking about the thermal output of the core or the real useful electrical energy coming out? I know that they run at medium efficiency, so those numbers are not super far apart. But now, if I've got this, let me start off with a gigawatt nuclear power station, and I want to build a super big hop transmitter with it. And you've now got to convert all of that electrical power into RF power. It's got a whole lot of individual generators going to a whole lot of individual phase shifters and amplitude adjusters going to your beamforming network, going to all of those individual elements of that phased array. we're talking about an awfully big investment here. And what are you going to get in return? I mean, that as a weapon doesn't strike me as a weapon, because the best you can do with that, if you really can do this focusing we are mentioning here, is focus that ionosphere in such a way that the energy coming out of the sun is going to hit the ground within a small number of miles of where you are. You're not going to do that 1,000 miles away. So it doesn't strike me as a practical weapon, if that's what somebody's thinking of. But maybe I'm way off on this one here. I'm going to have to leave you guys. I've been up kind of late doing this construction at my house. I've got to go to a bunch of meetings tomorrow, so I've got to leave you. Let me turn it over to Mel to say some final words. You guys can continue if you want to. K2KEY, have a nice week. 73, you all, try to be kind to each other. You got it, Mel.
That's me again.
Yeah, thank you. This is K2KEY. Very interesting to send these clients. I know we got to figure ways of reducing our dependence on oil. And I don't know if this nuclear power business is the answer, because they keep saying that, you know, every time we've had a problem, well, we know what the problem is. Next time around, it won't happen. But shows you, here we are, still worrying about nuclear power plants going crazy. I guess the Three Mile Island disaster and the Chernobyl and all. So, I don't know what the answer is, but surely maybe nuclear is not the final word on power. So, with that, say 73 to everybody, and catch you all next week. Thank you for joining us. This is K2KEY saying goodnight.
Yeah, some good comments there, Mel. I'm more in favor of renewable energy, wind, solar, tide, all of those. Nuclear is a tough way to go. When nuclear was first proposed, it looked like it was going to be such cheap power that we were going to abandon the watt-hour meters on people's houses and everybody was going to pay a flat rate, regardless of how much they used. Great-sounding proposal. Everyone forgot about the fact that where is the fuel coming from? It was a military operation, heavily funded by our government, that did all of the sourcing, refining, and everything else of the fuel. The total fuel cycle of nuclear power. The good news is it gives you independence. The bad news is it's expensive power. It is not cheap. When you look at the total fuel cycle of getting the stuff, refining it, transporting it, installing it, using it, taking it back out, storing it, transporting it, re-refining it, and then storing it again. Somewhere else. Very expensive cycle. So I'm not convinced that it's the panacea everyone thought it's going to be. And each one of these power stations is only good for a certain length of time before you get embrittlement and other kinds of breakdown. I got to go. Bye-bye, you guys. Think powerful thoughts. KQRW clear for now.
73-6, 73-7, KC2QIQ.
73, Dick. Thank you very much for all of your help. What the last comment of that is, what really struck me is that Stanford University made this dissertation submitted to the Department of Electrical Engineering and the Committee of Graduate Studies in partial fulfillment of the requirements for the degree of Doctor of Philosophy. And the rest of it is purely scientific physical study of mentioned subject. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Leslie, I have a question for you, though.
About you, idiot. Nobody cares what you're talking.
Please?
Yeah, Leslie, my question is this. After all you've read from the research on HARP and the studies from Stanford University, which most of those have read already, what makes you think that, other than adjusting the ionosphere, that there's some direct effect from HARP that could actually affect weather or some other physical structure outside of just the ionosphere?
You still can't make contact on HF.
The Stanford University employed this subject as the requirement for the doctorate of philosophy. That means that they are trying to get advantage from the mother of all of the sciences, to that particular aspect. That means I have employed a philosophy which was my major, and very much extensively educated, to the process of thinking. That means I don't think so. I'm speculating. I'm thinking if that is possible, that lensing could be applied, or mirroring and lensing could be applied for the purpose of reflecting energy from the ionosphere. And we know already that we may not have a problem with the power, because the power is there if one wants to use it. So the amount of power that, that is requirement for whatever effect to be measured and investigated is there. So, no, I don't think that it is happening. I'm just thinking that if it's happening, what then would be? Back to you.
Yeah, actually, my understanding of it, Wesley, is how the, you know, the effect of HARP and most of the documents that I've read on it and what they've done is it does have an effect on the ionosphere, and they do try to lens and control it and steer it as much as they can, but its general effects are on the electromagnetic radiation layer for especially low-frequency operations. So if you want to do low-frequency communications in the HF band, and interestingly enough, there is a radar system that operates called over-the-horizon radar, and the ability to see over the Earth. So if you can control or help improve ionization, it would improve that radar so that you can actually see what's going on around the globe. That is certainly one of the applications of the two working hand-in-hand, Wesley. KC2, KC2, QIQ. KC2, YDC,
let him talk a little bit, please.
KC2, YDC, recognize. Okay, that was what is mystery for me is that Japan earthquake and tsunami, and right before the earthquake, presence of the aurora over the skies of the Japan. I didn't snap it to any HARP program, and if one thinks that I'm doing that, it's simply assumption. I'm relating factors from the philosophical point of view, and we had a discussion about philosophy plenty of times with John, and I believe John could say a few words about that. So John, pick up, and then we have a Matt.
KC2WGV. Good evening, Glenn. What I found was the little bit of reading I've done on HARP. They're using 1 billion watts. Now, even if they had a lens that they're creating, as far as bringing that energy level back down to ground through some kind of transition, the effects it would have, I think, would be minimum. But don't forget, Wesley, you keep referencing the earthquake and the tsunami. The aurora they saw over Japan, first time in 26 years, happened at a previous earthquake. That fellow was not writing about this current one at this time.
Okay, very good. How you doing today? John, I was wondering if you're available for a quick call.
Yeah, man, go ahead. I'm here.
Okay, very good. KC2YDT.
Hey, call me too, okay?
Pick it up, Glenn.
No, no, it looks like I'm trying to connect work, scientific work of program HARP to the disaster of Japan. I'm not doing this. The only what I said about Japan and the earthquake is the presence of aurora. As far as any other speculation, it's purely up to the individuals. Maybe Glenn, you have any idea why of a sudden the aurora shows on the sky of Japan? Of course, the video that I have sent you is completely out of merit. Back to you.
Well, it's interesting that, some studies have been done where they've looked at the amount of solar activity, sunspot activity, and it just so happens that at present, sunspot activity is pretty high right now. Also, it had been at other times, and, does it really track the amount of earthquakes, especially around certain areas? And I'm not sure that it's really conclusive. And of course, aurora, it does happen more in the northern hemisphere. But we've seen it even here in New York, occasionally in certain winters where the sky is clear. You can actually see it during high sunspot activity cycles. And because I know I've seen it on Long Island in clear winters days. But here again, I'm not really sure that that there's a, something really corresponds to it. But what is interesting is that they have tracked is that if you look at the financial improvements, like when solar activity is high, generally the economy does very, very well. But unfortunately now the solar cycle is increasing, but it's not following that trend this time. Oh, darn. John, over to you. KC2QIQ.
John, pick up.
You want
to... John is probably on the phone still with Matt. The explanation that I heard from you. Could you tell me, if you take the lens, the glass lens, and you try to burn the piece of wood, what do you think is the amount of energy that's concentrated that could be stated in kilowatts if you would use the same amount of energy to create the same concentrated effect, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, let me pass it over to Bernie. Bernie, why don't you pick it up first, and then I'll comment to, back to Wesley again. KC2QIQ.
Good evening, gentlemen. Glenn, I need about maybe even just 90 seconds before you get done for the evening. I don't want to break up the conversation, and I'm curious to know how many kilowatts does it take to light wood up with a magnifier. So just save me 2 minutes before you decide to put your nightcap on. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I'd have to do a calculation, but I know it's somewhere like around between 1,200 and 1,400 degrees in order to do it. And depending on whether it's certainly, it would take less energy if you had to light the corner of a piece of paper as opposed to a piece of wood. It was obviously, if you ever try to start a fire as a Boy Scout, you always try to take the corner of a little piece of paper to get the fire going first, so, because that takes the least amount of energy. But I would say that probably under, a few watts, would probably all it would be, nowhere near a horsepower's worth, like, a kilowatt or anything like that. But just to light the side of a piece of paper to get it going, probably just, a few watts. To get a log of wood started, probably kilowatts, Wesley. So it probably depends on the surface area that you're trying to ignite. Wesley, back to you. KC2QIQ.
So that means that if you have 1 billion watts and artificial lensing in the ionosphere, would you be able to create a burn on the paper on the given area that the beam is concentrated, assuming that you are able to create as large lens as you want, or set of lenses?
Well, I think the problem with that would be this. If you look at the altitude of the ionosphere, and that's what the RF energy can actually control, the altitude is so way up there. It's above most of the clouds that we normally would use to control weather. And even the height or the altitude of clouds in most cases are, thousands of feet, where in order to create a focal length with enough magnification to focus to a point on Earth, it would be extremely difficult to get the wavelength of the sun's light, the frequency of sun's light, which is pretty broadband, basically prismed and focused at that altitude. If you've ever tried to use a lens to light paper or, you know, wood to create a fire, you have to get the lens almost has to be within one focal length of the object to create that heating. And that's actually quite close, Wesley. So, and it would have to be, and if you've ever tried to do it, it has to be an extremely stable focal point. So in other words, you'd have to be able to hold it very, very close to the object to get it to within one focal length, and you'd have to hold it very, very steady. Any slight movements or a non-steady hand throws it out, if you know what I mean. Let me pass it back to you, and then we'll see. Bernie, I think, has a question. I might have to go pretty soon. KC2 QIQ.
Okay. Thank you very much for all of the explanation. Well, I think that if the lensing is accomplishable, then with the steady presence of that lens is due also to the amount of power that is concentrated. You imagine the lines and the point of concentration that should be on the air, then the clouds are at the heated area, but still the concentration at point of clouds is not as great as the concentration on the given geographical point. But yes, I accept the explanation and thank you for your help. Bernie Mika.
Glenn, I was doing some work in the shop yesterday. I have a kit for an LCR meter. I picked it up a date and a year or two ago and just forgot to ever build it. It's a through-hole construction kind of kit. It has a lot of precision resistors in it. And I stumbled across two of the resistors are marked as zero-ohm resistors. And I thought that was incredibly odd, but then I found them in the package. They're a regular ceramic package with a single brown stripe on them. And I put, you know, measure them with the ohm meter to four-digit precision, and they are less than 1 ohm. They were, I think one of them was about 0.4 and some change, the other one was about 0.6 and some change. Why would they have zero-ohm resistors? The only theory I can think of is that they didn't want to put a jumper wire in, because if you were auto-stuffing these things, an auto-stuffing machine probably can't handle just bare wire, bending it and stuffing it in a hole to replace the resistor they don't want anymore. But any theory on why would you have a zero-ohm resistor?
Calibration.
Yeah, actually, Wesley brought up one of the good points of doing it. I use them all the time in design, and many times what I find, Bernie, is that I'll have a lot of circuitry on one board. So it's like the one-glove-fits-all routine, where on one PCB, I'll put footprints in so that I can create multiple circuits. But if that option isn't used, I can put a zero-ohm resistor in one area and short that out or open up another area. So a lot of times what I'll do is I'll put in JICs, or just-in-case positions, for components to create other accessories. And when those components, I need that location shorted because I'm not using an option, or use that short to ground an option or pull it up to to higher voltage again, I'll use the zero-ohm resistor in place to pull that circuit up. So many times they're just like options that allow you to do things. And in digital circuits, many times when you have a microprocessor, you can program zeros and ones on the input to the micro or addresses. In other words, do you ever see those switches that you go up and down on? If you just put footprints there, you don't have to put a switch in. Just populate the zero ohm resistors in the right place to create the correct digital address. KC2QIQ.
Breaking station acknowledged. I understand those points, but what I don't understand is how come you just didn't use a bare piece of wire? Why did you actually get something in a package versus just put a bare piece of wire across there? Glenn, and then the breaking station.
Well, two reasons. One is that certainly in the area of surface mount, where I do a lot of designing, is the cost to bend a piece of wire and form it and to stock it is actually more expensive than to get a, you know, a half a cent, you know, surface mount resistor. Even in through-hole resistors, they were available from years ago, mainly because the resistor can be purchased in high volume at very, very low pennies, and the jumper wire was actually more expensive. KC2QIQ. We'll pass it over to the breaking station, see what they have to say.
Good evening. This is Alan, NCKW. Glenn, you have a lot more experience in surface mount devices than I do. Both of your explanations were perfectly logical, but one explanation that neither of you seem to have thought of, that's another possibility, is it simply a fuse. Over to the station and ask the question.
Very valid point. It's in a it's around a voltage regulator, and yeah, maybe it is a fuse. It looks like a quarter watt package. It's the same size as a quarter watt resistor. It's carbon based and or a carbon style. So yeah, maybe it was a blow in place kind of thing where a wire wouldn't. So yeah, all good points. Yeah, this makes a lot of sense, guys, and I appreciate this. But I just have never seen a zero ohm resistor. Now, granted, my hands-on experience in a lab was 30 years ago, and when surface mount didn't even exist yet. But yeah, I just hadn't saw this, and I haven't really worked around high-volume stuffing machines. But I theorized that probably it's easier on the stuffer to stuff a, shall we say, a blank resistor than it is to bend a piece of wire special. So thank you. Over to the station. I didn't get your name, but over to you for any fill, and then back to Glenn.
Okay, Tuesday.
I don't have anything to add. This is Alan, N2KW. Back to you, Glenn, and you pick up KA2Z.
Yeah, I can add a couple of words to this. Actually, I don't generally in practice like to use zero-ohm resistors as fuses. I've known that some people have, and the reason I don't like using them is because when zero-ohm resistors burn, sometimes they burn ugly, and they'll expose material onto a board, so you know they'll smoke and they'll burn, and you can get some very very small surface mount fuses about the same size as you know 1206 or 0603 resistor sizes, so they could be dropped in. So there's really no real need to use the zero ohm as a fuse because the fuses are available in those sizes. Just one other note there too is the fuse doesn't have much effect with temperature. In which temperature, they'll blow almost very precision at a certain amount of current, where the zero-ohm resistor, as the temperatures change, you can get more current. It's not a very, very controlled operation. So if you can use the fuse, you're always much better off using the fuse than the resistor. And the fuses are really cheap now, too, especially in service mount. Eric, over to you, KC2QIQ.
KC2QIQ, K2J Mobile. I just wanted to make 2 points. One, all throughout 2010, it was like, I think it was 86 days with absolutely zero sunspots. So last year was like, you know, people were scratching their heads why there was no solar activity. That's one thing. Although, I think today, I checked on space weather, we're up a little bit. Great spot, beginning to come back. The fun explanation was, if he hasn't followed the cycle as we'd be expected it to. So, you know, your theory about the economy and being bad, well, no solar activity last year, bad economy. So, it seems to hold through still. And the other thing that you guys didn't mention is, in a lot of stuff that I have and work with, we generally use zero on surface mount resistors. You know, there's a shunt.
That's a bad idea. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, very good point, Eric. Yeah, because when you start getting to the low ohms, resistors, you know, it's very, very difficult to, but if you have trimmed zero ohm resistors that are pretty consistent, you can actually make a shunt out of them. Nice little trick, and well noted. Let me pass it back to Bernie, because I'm going to actually have to sign on this one, guys. I got to go to work tomorrow, but always a pleasure, and talk to you guys soon. KC2 QIQ 73 is over to you, Bernie.
Oh, well, thank you, Glenn, 73s. I figured you'd have a good answer for it. It just kind of surprised me. At first, I thought it was a typo. Then I figured it was a fix and an oops. But the part about the auto-feeding was the part that I just couldn't come up with an answer for. So thank you very much. Have a great evening. Over to you, Eric.
Hey, Bernie, did your travel take you anywhere this evening?
No, I didn't have any time. I had to teach that technician class this morning. I'd forgotten about that, so that sucked up all my ham radio playtime for today. So I'm just getting done with my chores in Elmhurst and headed home now.
It would have been a good evening, but next time.
I understand. Tired. You know, sometimes you just don't feel like playing anymore.
We'll get it done eventually. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I've been buried in the basement. I gotta make a stop here and put some petrol on the car, and I'll be back in a minute. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, KE2J.
Good evening, Bernie. I guess Eric's gonna put another quart of water in his car.
And he had to get out and turn that crank to crank the rubber bands up again. Eric's the green guy of the crowd. Me, I'm the one that drives the gas-guzzling piece of Bavarian architecture. The one good news is I'm getting closer to getting my LCR meter working so that I can go wind coils like a winding fool.
Yeah, actually, John has a beautiful piece of equipment for that purpose, John.
I don't think he wants to spend 12 grand for a piece of equipment to wind a coil.
Do you have a coil winding machine or an LCR meter?
No, a micro test LCR meter.
I think about it. It's absolutely beautiful piece of equipment. Eric was trying to help me out with it. It is working properly. It does have a problem with memory. But other than that, it is performing absolutely great. And it's extremely accurate. Eric, are you there?
He's getting fuel for his vehicle.
Okay.
Richie into EO, and Hal turned me on to a Chinese import LCR meter that they put up against Hal's 4.5-digit bench machine, and they said it was deadly accurate, so I invested a whole $28, $29 or something like that in it, so I'm curious to see how that one turns out.
How much does it cost?
I believe I paid $29 and about $7 or $8 shipping.
No, nothing even close, John.
No, you'll probably have a good shot at that. If you're comparing it against instruments and it's accurate, that's a good way to go. Wow, for those kind of bucks, that's some bang for the buck. Disposed inductance, capacitance, it does a lot of other things, but as it says, and it's extremely accurate at different frequencies you can set it for. It's a lot of bells and whistles, but it works extremely well.
Keep in mind, guys, I just need to be able to figure out whether I've got continuity on the coil I wound.
I'm not looking for the kind of laboratory equipment you guys have. I just need something. So give me some vague. Do I have enough turns or not?
China, but it's made in Taiwan. There was probably over $10,000 a device when it was new. So the main problem is they don't go that high. You can measure the inductance at the frequency of 50 hertz or 100 hertz. How about if you go to 150 kilohertz or if you go to 500 kilohertz? Now the inductive component or the capacitive component is quite different. So I remember when I spoke to Eric, it was a long time ago, and I was asking a question. He said, "What frequency?" I say, "What? What frequency are you making this measurement?" But these things doesn't even tell you the frequency, but you. But
I understand. You guys are in a different league than I am. I'm just trying to build a couple of coils to put into a radio kit, and you guys are making laboratory kind of measurements. So I'm just trying to find out, did I put enough lines on, you know, that might be even vaguely in the right neighborhood, that kind of stuff. So I'm, shall we say, I'm looking for field-grade stuff, and you guys are using laboratory-grade stuff. John?
Okay, dude, thanks.
Yeah, but you'll get there quicker, I'm sure, and just as accurate, without a doubt. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, buddy, what are you making coils for?
I'm ordering a what's called a Soft Rock 40 radio. It's an SDR radio kit. Mostly surface mount stuff, but obviously for the RF it needs coils. So it's got, I don't know, 8 or 10 coils that have to get wound on them. I haven't wound a coil since I was about 12 years old, so I'm kind of getting back to speed up, or getting back, either back up to speed or up to speed the first time.
All right, well, if you know what inductance you need, open up the ARRL handbook. There's a table in there that gives you the inductance for the number of turns at a particular diameter with a particular kind of wire. And what frequency is resonant at. So there's no magic there. There's also a formula if you want to, you know, make something odd yourself.
Actually, there's a very cool website that sells cores, and they have calculators to tell you how many turns you need. They have a calculator that will tell you how many pieces of wire of what gauge will fit through a specific toroid. Basically, it's got all the details of that. I'm just looking for something to do QA checks to check my work to make sure that I've got what I think I have.
All right, well, you could use a signal generator and a voltmeter if you really want to check it, or you could just use your eyeballs and count the number of turns.
Or I could use my $30 LCR meter that I'm getting from China.
Yeah, you could use that too.
Why I have to step out to go to the post office box. Over to you, John.
Okay, Bernie. Good luck at the post office box. So what are you doing tomorrow, Wes?
Yeah, I have a deadline for the taxes at Tuesday for the corporate, and I've got to deal with that. And then I have a sales tax at 20th, so mostly I'm going to be preparing myself for the taxes. That's what I'm going to be doing. Apart from that, very much educational. I'm very glad we touched so many subjects today. And talking about the LCR meters, the first LCR meters that I have purchased was Sencor LC102, which is still a great one. And it is not very expensive, widely available. You can buy it off eBay, Bernie, and it's really worth your money. It does give you the capacitance, inductance, and resistance. but it also gives you the capacitor leakage, capacitance value, dielectric absorbance, and capacitor ESR if you're dealing with the capacitors. And you can, especially with the breakdown value, you can set up, let's say, 1,000 volts, and it will not break the capacitor, but it will tell you what is the exact voltage that the capacitor will hold on it. So, yes, I've got this one. But most of the measurements that I'm doing, let me drop.
John wants to take you out on
is Hewlett-Packard gain phase analyzer. And I'm pretty satisfied with this one. It's absolutely amazing stuff. Impedance gain phase analyzer 4194A. Bernie, back to you.
Okay, I'll look up that Syncor when I get back to the house here. Sounds interesting. This whole coil thing is just something I've never really dealt with. I came out of the digital world, so we use mostly resistors. We use capacitors to keep the digital spikes from messing up the processors. So that was pretty much the extent. Oh, well, I was a telephone guy too, so we used 600 ohm transformers quite a bit, a few relays. But that was kind of my extent of knowledge. So this coil thing's a whole new gamut for me, John.
Okay, Bernie. Yeah, you just keep plugging away. You'll get it done. When do you think you'll have this complete?
Hey, Bernie. Ethernet adapter to full coil.
Yeah, never worked on network gear. I always bought appliances and used them. None of my work experience has been inside of that stuff. John, don't have the kit yet. I've got it on order. Unfortunately, the Great South Bay Club ordered like 20 of these. They did a group buy and sucked the manufacturer dry. So I'm hoping to get it in another week or two.
Wow, that's a good deal. Well, it'll be something interesting to see how that comes out. Over to you, Wes.
And thanks, Jen. Talking about measurement stuff. You know what? Eric may disagree with that, but I think he doesn't need anything. A piece of electrical tape, a pair of pliers, and like he said, he takes the amount of winds and the diameter and the thickness of the wire from the internet. And he's got what he needs. Simplicity. That's what I've noticed when I spoke to him. You can have a bunch of the stuff, but the task could be achieved with very little of this equipment. Eric, pick up.
Hey, look, you know, folks have been making coils without all that fancy gear for years. It works just fine. You know, a little math will do you. But, you know, like, you really need a VNA. Yeah, actually, I could use one right now. I'm modifying a 2-meter radio right on 220, and it'd be nice to see the whole thing. But, you know, I don't have one, so I have to use a tracking generator and a spectrum analyzer. That'll do the job. Same difference. You know, work with what you got. John?
Well, you won't be able to do anything until you get the hell out of that basement. And then you'll be able to move forward. Then we'll be able to hear you on the radio every day. Over to you, Wes.
Yeah, Eric reminds me of these guys from Russia. They are doing experiments and achieving something, having a very little of equipment around, just pure knowledge and logic. You know, that's what I like. So, Bernie, when are you going to be up to the task?
Well, I'm currently being outsmarted by the clock in my car. Just having to change the time at twice a year is highly annoying because I never can remember how to do it. But I'm going to go clear, guys. I'm destiny here at the house. Got to move the cars around so the wife doesn't wake me up in the morning when she leaves. And all of that fun stuff. So 73s, always a pleasure to speak with you. K2I will be clear. Over to you, John.
Bernie, have a great evening. Yeah, you know, you got to press one button and hold it while you pulse another button. You'll get the clock to work. Over to you, Wes.
Yeah, I was wondering when Eric will be done with his renovation stuff and whatever he's doing in the basement, so I could start to send him also the emails with the material that I'm discussing with Glenn and Dick and you, Eric.
That hurt. Something hurt me, hurt you. I suppose about, I got about another 5 or 6 weeks worth of work. By the end of the 5 or 6 weeks, I should have the tower put up, and then the neighbors are going to hate me. And I'll be more available. Because, you know, I'm fixing up the house in Plainview, and that's where we're going to be moving to. Once I get it done, and tomorrow I go out and buy some windows for the basement and take out the old pieces of garbage and put them in. I've got the basement waterproof now. I just did half of the floor with an epoxy paint and I'm gonna let that dry. And then tomorrow hopefully I can finish up the other half of that and then put the walls up and then put the lab in. Not worry about the rest of the house. John?
So I guess you should be basically moved in by June, I would imagine. That sounds like a good date. That'll be great. So you'll be back on the radio at that time. Very good. Over to you, Wes.
I was renovating quite a few apartments and extensively renovating. And there is a say between Polish contractors who are, most of them are in the area of renovation and building. They say, if the expense of renovation does not kill you, all is left is just the property tax. And the reason that we're talking about is because most of these guys spent so much time and effort trying to get to the end of the renovation that when the property tax came, they barely were able to hold to the surface to not get it drowned. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, I have to be careful with the power oil today. I'm getting some things done. You know, I'm getting rid of the oil burn and putting in gas. And I mean, the building inspector is going to come. So I'm going to do all the major stuff, that, you know, because they want permits for everything. And the last thing I need to do is let them reassess the house. So I'll do the stuff that they're going to see and let that stuff get done, and then I'll do the rest. I went on their website and see, you need a permit. You need a permit if you're going to change a toilet bowl. It's absurd.
Yeah, you're right, Eric. If you read the rules, the building department, you need a permit for almost anything. It's unbelievable. And then you have somebody come, and like you say, they measure the house, they reassess it, they see new work in there. Oh, did you do that? No, that's the way it was. That's the way you got to be. It's a shame. It really is stupid. But if you just get a very high efficiency oil burner, they're doing much better than some of the gas burners. And I know I put one into my house. Extremely high efficiency. I cut my oil bills in half, 50%.
John, I'm very surprised about that. I have two oil tanks, and I'm thinking about getting out of the property because they are not even in the houses. They are outside of the houses, between two buildings. And just standing for years, not being used. As the previous owner told me that the reason that he switched to gas was the high price of the oil, heating oil. So I'm completely confused about that. John? Not John. Eric?
Andrew Graham and Company, K2J. Well, yeah, they have more efficient oil burners, but they still stink. And the tank takes up room, and if you put the tank outside, that's a whole other big deal, and it's like, I don't want it, I don't need it. I'm doing radiant heat anyway, and besides, the house in Astoria, I got rid of the oil burner and went to gas, and even though gas is a little more expensive, it's far more efficient. And this house has hydronic heating, so I get rid of a lot of the old inset radiators and put in just a teeny little bit of baseboard. And I'm doing radiant heat on the main floor, and that's pretty damn efficient. And it's actually the neighbor next door has it, and it's quite comfy. I like it. So that's what I'm going to do there. And then, of course, the solar panels and the hot water panel is going to help, so I'm going to try and use as little electricity as I can, because all the lighting is going to be LED. I got the equivalent of like 2,000 watts of light, and it draws maybe about 40 watts, so that'll be a big cost saving. Yeah, I got a couple other things in the works, but one thing at a time. John?
Oh yeah, that's the way to go, LED lighting, absolutely. I cannot believe the amount of lumens you can get out of such a small device. And all those quartz and halogen and those floodlights, wow, they cost a lot of money to run. I changed my entire house over to those silly fluorescent ones now, even the hi-hats. And, you know, low voltage, they give you a little flicker once in a while. Other things are, if it's really cold, they don't start as fast. Sometimes, especially outside, it becomes a problem. But I think you're doing the right thing, and you should have a nice, efficient house there. Over to you, Wes.
Yeah, he's dealing with it quite a while already. I remember usually there was approximately 2-3 months per apartment. That's how much time it took me to renovate completely each one. And the jacuzzis, the marble, the granite, the stuff, the iron tables, and cathedral ceilings, all of this stuff. Quite surprisingly, I didn't do anything in my apartment. And the reason for that is I don't need it. I'm not a luxury man. I don't need to spend the money on myself. And who am I going to show it to? There's nobody coming to my house apart from my wife and my friends. Back to you, Eric.
Well, I borrowed one of my friend's thermal cameras and took a look at the house. That house was built in the 50s, and, you know, the insulation is wall. On wall. It's like R1, R2. It loses most of its heat, you know. In 2 weeks, they're going to rip all the walls down, rip out all the old insulation, and re-insulate the place, and hopefully bring it up to like R21, R22, something like that. It's going to be much better. It gets cold in the winter. And, then I've got my whole house computer control, and, you know, everything's getting Cat 6, and a bunch of RG6 cables to the appropriate locations, and do a little automation, and some electronic door locks, and some cameras. It'll be fun. John?
What size service do you have for that house? 150 amp? And are you going to change the service too? Because you're going to rewire the inside when you strip all that off. And you're right, insulation pays. It doesn't cost money. Absolutely. That's the way to go. Over to you, Wes.
Yeah,
We're going to lose the repeater in a second.
I can fix that.
Okay. It looks like we're dealing with this person who not only have a time to work, but he has a time to work. For instance, after the work hours, he is sitting another 8 hours in his house. That's good. Yeah, what I was saying, Eric, I wonder when you go to bed. I mean, 8 hours at work, 8 hours at work, at home. I mean, how many hours a day do you sleep?
I generally sleep about 6 hours. So, yeah, don't forget, I only work 3 days a week, so. That works out well.
Done. Hi there.
Maybe his phone rang.
But John is the guy who goes to bed very late. John. Didn't hear that that you said I can fix that. That's why.
Oh well. He does go to bed late. I mean, you know, I was talking to him last night until what became one. It was a pretty heavy duty discussion.
Yeah, I wonder how do you deal with the camera system? This is the standalone building, so you need at least 4 cameras at the corners, but at the same time in the front you need 3 cameras in order to be able to see one going to aiming the front door, and 2 of the cameras from the corners aiming the driveway and the area in front. At the same time, you need the coverage from the side. At least 1 camera, but it may not be enough if you want to do it right way. Back to you.
What are you talking about? Using 1 camera to look at 2 different angles?
When you have a front of the house, from 1 corner, 1 camera is facing towards the door. The 2nd camera from another corner is facing at 45 degrees. So it is covering the right side wall of this building and giving you approximately a 90 degrees view. Then from the same corner, when you have the camera facing the door, you have another camera from the opposite right side. So you have 2 cameras on the one side and 1 camera on the other side of the front wall. Now this camera is giving the view across, again, 90 degrees. So then you have like a straight coverage, whatever is in front and whatever is next to the door, close so you could see the faces. And I wonder, how did you solve that?
I'm not that paranoid. I don't need that kind of coverage. But if I was going to do that, what I'd probably do is put up a convex mirror and point the camera to convex mirror. Mount the mirror appropriately and actually mount the mirror on the roof in the corner and shoot up at it, and you can see one of the buildings on both sides.
Okay. Well, not necessarily as good, because you aim into the top of the head, so you never see the faces.